We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From WILL, Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. The producers for the program are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. Our technical director is Henry Frain. On the program today, Computers in You, this is a topic we'll take up here in the 11 o'clock hour of Focus from time to time every month. And the days have shifted a little bit, so we'll leave that out of the equation for the moment. This month, Peter Kimball is our guest. He is with the Fast 3 Consortium Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Listeners, I welcome your questions about computers for Peter Kimball. Join us with a telephone call or by email. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu, will-talk@illinois.edu. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Peter, welcome back. Good to see you.
It's good to be back. Thank you.
All right. We already have a couple of listeners ready and waiting.
Well, let's get started.
Okay. First, we go to a listener in St. Joe on line one. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. Question on maintenance. With my Windows 98, I ran the maintenance wizard about every 30 days. It would defragment, scan the disk, and clean it up, disk and compression stuff. So now that I have a Windows 7, and I just wondered, do I need to develop a maintenance schedule comparable to that Windows 98?
Well, Windows 7 is going to handle a lot of the general maintenance for you in the background. It's not nearly as critical as it was for Windows 98. However, it certainly wouldn't hurt periodically to go and do a defragmenting, and there are Windows utilities that come with Windows 7 that will do that. If you go into, depending on how your system was set up, Windows Accessories System Tools probably is where it's located, the Start Menu, Accessory Programs, Accessories System Tools, something like that. There will be a defragmenter there. In general, however, you'll have much less problem with Windows 7 than with the other ones. So I wouldn't worry about doing it monthly, but if your hard drive starts to get relatively full, which is going to probably be a lot longer off than it was in the old days because drives have so much greater capacity now, certainly doing a defragment on your own would not hurt anything and could help a little bit.
Okay. So I'm at Accessories, so I go to System Tools, and I'm there. Would be just defragmenter. There it is. Yes. Okay. So that's done in the background, huh?
The full defragmenting is not done at the background. Windows 7 just does a better job of trying to maintain a less fragmented hard drive as it goes. There's not actually, as far as I'm aware, a defragmenting that runs automatically in the background periodically. It's just that the disk doesn't tend to get quite as fragmented, but certainly you can with Windows 7 and any modern machine, you could just start that thing up and go ahead and continue to do your normal work. You don't have to wait for that defragmenting to finish like you did with some of the older versions
right.
of Windows.
Okay, wonderful. What about deleting cookies? Any guidance on cookies?
Well, yes, we can say a couple of things about cookies. Cookies, for those who are unaware, are the little bits of information, generally a number of some sort, that is placed on your hard drive by websites you visit so that that same website can recognize you when you come back. It's the only way that you can have certain sites, for example, your main news page or your New York Times page or whatnot, have the customization for you. You can delete them. There is probably not a great deal of security concerns these days, and you'll lose some functionality from some sites if you do delete the cookies, but it's certainly easy enough to do, depending on whether you're using Internet Explorer or Firefox or some other browser. You'll typically find it under Tools menu, I think, on Internet Explorer, and I'm not quite sure where it is on Firefox. but it's not a major concern. They don't take up very much space, so it's certainly not anything that's going to clog your system up. More space would be freed if you actually went into the browser and said to delete all the various cached images and pages, because whenever you visit a website, the browser will store all of that information so it can be retrieved more quickly later or displayed more quickly without having to go to the original server. And that can actually easily get up to dozens or hundreds of megabytes. But both Firefox and Internet Explorer allow you to control how much space you want to allot to that before it automatically starts deleting the old information. So the short answer is you probably don't have to worry about it. You can delete it if you wish, but be aware if you delete them all, you'll have to recustomize some of the web pages you visit frequently.
My last question is, do you have a recommendation how frequently to burn a backup and restore CD/DVD?
Well, the short answer is make a backup anytime. You'd hate to have to lose whatever you've done since the last time you did a backup. Burning a CD certainly will accomplish that. If you don't have a lot of material, burning a CD takes a little bit of time. It's slightly inconvenient, but not nearly as so as losing all of your data.
Right.
If you have kept things pretty well organized so that you just have two or three folders in which the changing information appears, such as one for documents and one for your photos and such, it's pretty easy to do either a full backup to a DVD or a CD. The other possibility that a number of people do, which is actually quite a bit simpler and quicker but has a little bit of added expense, is to get one of the $70 or $80 external hard drives that can now hold 500 gigabytes or more for that amount of money.
Okay.
And just back up to that. And if you have a couple of those, back up to one month, back up to the other month. And anytime you've done some major project or have a major set of images, just do a in-between interim backup of that information just to keep it safe.
Oh, okay. Great, great. And they just plug in the USB port?
Yeah, the software that will be on them will actually tell you how to deal with it. You have a couple of choices. Some of them, such as the MyBook series from Western Digital, will actually ask you if they can install backup software and handle it automatically. A number of people I know don't care for that backup software, so they just don't run that and just use it as another external hard drive, like a Drive G or a Drive H or whatever it may be. And you can just drag and drop and copy, and it makes it very simple. But,
right.
Yes, they just plug into a USB port or into a FireWire port. If you've got that, there are about two or three different ways they can connect, depending on the model that you get.
So you would recommend that versus burning a CD or DVD?
Mostly because people tend to do that more often. It's much less hassle than actually burning the DVD or CD. Any would work. Either technique would work, but what's easiest tends to get done more often and more regularly.
So there on that, it's just a desktop hard drive is what it's called?
It's just an external hard drive.
Yeah, okay. But when you plug it in the USB port, then there are directions of how to proceed?
Yes.
Okay, great. Great, thanks, Peter.
You're quite welcome.
Okay, and next we go to a listener waiting for us in Chicago on line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My problem is Microsoft updates. I have it on automatic, and I get an error message which says that the following updates were not installed. By the way, I'm running XP SP3.
Okay.
And there are a list of eight or nine things that were not updated. I've tried going to the Microsoft site and downloading those that are listed, you know, these KB, I'm sorry, the KB.
Yes, that knowledge base.
Yeah, knowledge base, right. And there are about three of those. I've tried downloading those individually and it doesn't work. Any suggestions?
Well, there are a couple of things you can do. This is a fairly common problem, and actually, Microsoft support website has a couple of articles about it. One I'm looking at currently is titled, "You Cannot Install Updates from Windows Update, Microsoft Update, or by Using Automatic Update." which is exactly what you're experiencing. And the problem is typically, well, I'm looking to see if I can give you a quick solution to this. What I'm going to do is I'm going to point you to the actual article. There is a file that is perhaps not properly installed, what's called a DLL file, that is not properly registered. That's the most common problem. So there are a series of steps that should reset your Windows update capability. It's certainly the first line of defense and action that Microsoft suggests for both Windows XP, SP3, as well as SP2. And the address that you'll want to use to get to this article, which will give you step-by-step instructions, are to go to, well, of course, the http://business.support.microsoft.com/KB, that's short for knowledge base.
Sorry, say that again.
Okay, support.microsoft.com slash KB as in knowledge base.
Oh, KB. Okay.
KB as in as King Boy, right. / 943144.
Great. Okay, I'll try that.
And that'll give you a couple of things to do, and one or the other of them should take care of the situation. You're not alone. It has happened to a number of people, thus this article on the Microsoft Update site.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay. I'll try it and get back to you.
Good luck with it.
Next, we talk with a listener in Edgewood on line one. Hi.
Hi. I may have a problem here that is operator error. I have one of the MyBook backup systems. I was trying to be responsible, and
yes.
I had about 14 gigs on my hard drive. And when I went to back it up, and then the next time you plug it in, it's supposed to sync everything and anything new is supposed to be added. But what happened was, apparently, it ended up re-downloading everything back onto my computer, so now I have about 42 gig on my hard drive, and I didn't really add anything like pictures or anything else. So now, near as I can tell, and I don't know how to tell, I have everything on there at least three times, and I noticed it in my iTunes, and I don't know how to get rid of all this stuff, okay? Do you know where I'm coming from? Is this a question that can even be... That you can even address?
I can certainly address it. I don't know if I can give you the ultimate answer. And just like the last caller, you're not alone in this. Part of the difficulty you're having is because the backup software that comes with the MyBook hardware, which is what will install by default when you first plug it in. It says, would you like to install this software, etc. And it is very obscure in its function and does things in a fairly awkward and clumsy way. And for that reason, a number of people have, when they get the MyBook hardware, which is very convenient to use, simply don't use the backup software that comes with it from Western Digital. So what can you do? The best solution would be to see if you can open this. If you just open Windows Explorer, double-click on My Computer, see the drive, and see if you can just see all of the various files there without using the MyBook backup software. You should then see all of those files in all the various folders. Now, it may be fairly cryptically named because the MyBook backup software is trying to keep track of when the update was made and bundles things into various folders. But at that point, you'll have a couple of options once you are looking at it not through the MyBook backup software. Windows itself would allow you to delete any of the directories that contain like the first and second copies of the backup, and would also allow you to simply create a folder and backup the files that you need manually just by dragging and dropping, although that works best if there are a fairly limited number of folders in which you've been keeping things. For example, some people have a documents folder, or it could even be My Documents or your own personalized folder, and just drag all of that content. You don't really want to back up the entire hard drive because, of course, much of it is software and operating system. So going into Windows Explorer, double-clicking on my computer and see if you can see while that My Book is plugged in, you should see a drive letter indicating that external hard drive, and then just work with it manually. As far as what you need to do to get My Book to stop making a complete backup each time, there are settings in their software someplace, but after I first experienced that software, I got rid of it, so I can't really tell you which way to go there.
Could the listener do a search on that, Peter, online, and come up with some?
There's a good chance if they were to try to do my book backup problems or something like that.
Mm.
Bypassing it
is the way to go.
Sometimes the way to go, yeah.
Okay.
My book backup problems.
Listener, want to have a follow up?
Now that I've apparently got all these things on there three times, is there any way to get rid of them?
You should be able to get rid of them someplace inside the My Book backup software. There should be an option to purge old backups. Or you can just do it the manual way and use Windows Explorer by just opening, double clicking again on my computer and looking at it directly. But if you're going to continue using the My Book backup software, which can indeed work, it's just a little bit counterintuitive.
I'm now fearful of using it. So am I better off with a with one of the little you plug into your USB ports?
The little thumb drives?
Yeah. Am I better off just going that?
Well, the problem is you have much lower capacity on the thumb drive.
Sure.
You're only going to have a relatively small amount of space there. You'll have hundreds of gigabytes available on the external hard drive like the MyBook. Certainly, it doesn't hurt anything for you to have all those extra backup copies. And if you're just not going to use the MyBook, then you've just got a bunch of extra storage capacity that you're not using. If you do decide not to use the MyBook, then what you can do is just reformat that whole MyBook hard drive, the external hard drive, and just use it as a standard external drive, which will put the responsibility on you to drag the files that you want to keep over to it. The other possibility is to look at backup program reviews. Just do a Google or a Bing search for those, because there are a number of much better backup programs. Better in that they're more intuitive and are less likely to give you lots of extraneous stuff that are available that you could use instead of the software that comes bundled with the MyBook. Because it is underneath it all just a standard hard drive. It does not have to be run with the MyBook software.
Okay, I hope that helps. This is Focus, and we're talking this morning about computers. Our guest today, Peter Kimball. He's with the Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this morning with questions about computers by phone or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line two. Hello. Line two?
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Yes. I was wondering if, a number of years ago there was a program called P-Copy, and it would copy everything on a drive that was newer than the existing copy on the backup drive. And I was looking for it the other day, and I didn't find it. I was wondering if there's something similar. It was sort of an improved X copy.
Right. I was just did a look. Interestingly enough, P-Copy is short for Peter's disk-to-disk copying tool. But the website that I get to from it, was last updated in 2002. So it looks like it is now primarily, let's see, it looks like it may be designed more for use with a Unix machine than with Windows. Certainly there are a number of programs. It sort of ties into what the last caller was asking. You're looking for, in essence, a backup program that can look for files that have been changed since the last time a copy was made. And you will find dozens, if not hundreds of those, some of them commercial for $40-$50. Some of them shareware. What you want to do is just a search for backup software, and you'll find, and I would actually take that search a step further and type something like backup software reviews, and you're likely to get to either PC World or CNET or PC Magazine reviews of such backup software, which is exactly what you want to do. You want to be able to specify a set of folders on your hard drive in which you would like this program to look, and constantly, or whatever schedule you set, copy anything that is newer than the last time it was copied.
Yes. One of the problems I have, or caveats I have, with a lot of the backup software is you don't seem to be able to go into the backup and pick out a single file.
Some of them indeed will not allow you to do that easily. That's why I would suggest that when you do the search and examine what some of your options are, you look at the reviews, because certainly, I don't recall when it was, but it was within the last few months anyway on PC Magazine, they had a review, and they include those sorts of usability features, how easy it is to retrieve a single file or to see what file copies are available from a particular range of dates, etc. Well done, backup software should indeed address that issue. Poorly done, just kind of quick and dirty software just makes a copy that makes it a little bit more difficult to extract single files.
Which is the problem with the included software in Windows. It was with XP.
Well, yes, I'm not actually sure, because I don't use that software. It's certainly one of the issues that the last caller had with the built-in backup software that came with his MyBook.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of well-done software packages out there that probably do what PCopy used to do, but much more effectively, and of course now for updated for Windows, more
and
recent versions of Windows.
And probably compress. You say that was the last issue of PC Magazine?
No, it was sometime within the last few months.
Oh, okay.
I don't recall precisely when, but either doing a search there or just doing a generic search. If you include the what I almost always do when I'm looking for software, I don't include the name or of the software or the category without also including the word reviews in the search, so that I can.
Well, I'll do that.
See what
Thank
we can
you so
find.
Much.
You're quite welcome.
You're very welcome. This is Focus. Our guest today, Peter Kimball. We're talking about computers. Listeners, if you've got a question about a computer, give us a call. Peter will do his best to help you out. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. You can also join us by email, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. Well, we've got a lull here in the calls, and I see that you have some notes there in front of you, and I'm thinking he came with a couple of things he wanted to address.
I did. In fact, part of this was at the suggestion of a caller last month. Since summertime is the time when many people are traveling and wanting to maintain computer access, checking their email, etc., some general safety tips, if you will, some general advice. I don't know how much we'll have time to do, but basically I'll start by saying there are two categories of ways you might keep in touch. One is you carry your laptop with you. The other is you use publicly available machines, such as in hotels and such. And I'll just start by very quickly addressing the use of public machines, such as hotels.
Mm-hmm.
The most important thing there, you don't really know what is on that computer. You don't know if it if somebody has installed keylogging software. So the general advice is just wait to do all your financial transactions until you get home. It's certainly all right to check email, but be cautious. And if you're using a public computer, again, even though most in the hotel will probably be fine, make sure that you, if you're allowed to, delete all the contents of the browser's cache, empty the recycle bin. If you've worked on documents, delete those. Make sure backup documents are not there, and actually close the browser window down if you have an opportunity to do that, although some software installations at some hotels don't allow you access to all of that. But you just really can never be 100% certain if it's not your computer.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about something. Here at the station, we've got a couple of laptops that go out on the road, so to speak, and the station has invested in some kind of insurance so that they can be traced if they're stolen. And I want to say it like costs $99 for 3 years or something. And I was just wondering, what is that all about? And are there reviews out there on that kind of thing? Is it worth the money?
There are reviews. Basically, what it does is sort of like the automobile theft deterrence. What it does is install a program on your computer in a fairly hidden area, so somebody who gets the computer can't find it. And you also, for the fee, register your computer with whatever the company mm-hmm. is. And what the computer will do any time it's connected to the internet is it will send out a message to the central repository saying, okay. Hi, here I am, which normally will cause nothing to happen. But if your computer is stolen, what you do is you call the company, they put a flag on it, and the next time that your computer calls home, they then will know in general where it's coming from and will hopefully be able to track it down.
Pick it up.
So that's basically it. It's kind of a phone home. There was a example of this, not using that particular software, but it was in the news a few months ago about somebody whose, I think it was a Macintosh, had been stolen. They had it set up to take photos and put them on the web, and so they had the person who had stolen it sitting there, you know, in front of the computer, not realizing their picture was being taken and posted to a Facebook page or something.
Yeah.
And the police were able to catch the guy.
Same thing happened recently with a cell phone that was stolen. Somebody took their picture and posted it, and
in general, those who steal laptops and cell phones may not be among the most computer literate and among the brightest stars in the sky.
Okay, well, let's take another call. This is from a listener in Edgar County, line one. Hi.
Good morning. I have a couple of questions I'd like to ask about. My computer, which is old, and it's not going to get replaced anytime soon because of other needs that I have. So the thing is, first of all, are you aware that Verizon has sold out to a Frontier corporation?
I'm unaware of any such thing.
Well, they announced it on their web page last month, when you came up to your emails, that as of July 1st, they were transferring all of their properties, you know, anyone that had a computer work with Verizon to this Frontier, and that on January 1st, you had to change your email.
I'm just looking to see what I can find with that Verizon Frontier deal. Good for Wall Street, bad for you, it says here, one headline. Now that I see this, looks like that's going to be for their landlines, and changing the email address is probably something that is unavoidable with that. Certainly in the Champaign-Urbana area, as the local cable company has changed two or three times over the last several years, people who have had email addresses with one of the companies have had to change to the other. So, yes, I'm now aware of that, and there's not a whole lot you'll be able to do about it other than change your email address or get an email address that is a little bit more permanent, such as one from Google, a Gmail or
well,
such
that,
address.
Well, that's when I talked to someone from Verizon, they were a little bit conspiratorial and told me, you know, really, why don't you get a Gmail?
because given all of the merger frenzy that's going on with telecom companies, I would say that Gmail addresses are likely to be more long-lived than most of the others.
Are they as reliable?
One would assume yes. Of course, that is web-based emails, so it's going to be as reliable as Google in general is, and they've got millions, tens of millions, perhaps hundreds of millions of Gmail addresses, and a lot of people use them as their primary addresses, so I would not feel any concern about their reliability.
Yeah, well, of course, the problem I face is the fact is that I've, you know, had this for 8 or 9 years, And I don't even remember some of the emails people that I've been in contact with.
Well, that is always a problem. You can certainly, with all of the recent correspondence, send them an notice that your email address is changing. Verizon may make possible a automatic update so that any mail that comes in, I know that some private email servers can do this, can send a message back. But the good news is if there are people from 8 or 9 years ago that you've not exchanged email with more recently.
Well, I'm not saying it's been 8 or 9 years.
Okay.
But it's been a couple, 3 years. I don't keep a hard list of emails of people that I'm in contact with.
Well, there may well be. I would check with Verizon if you actually found somebody who was pretty helpful there and say, how can I notify people automatically of my new email address?
They
probably
have
some
individually.
No. Well, then your option would be, other than individually, if you fetch, depending on what program you're using to read your email with, if you actually are using a client program, something like Outlook or Eudora, an older program.
No.
Okay. So you may be stuck, as far as I'm aware of, with doing it individually. You can get probably most of your correspondence updated since you've got about 6 months or so to go until they pull the plug on your Verizon email. But if you're just using a, just going onto the web to read the email, I don't think there are any, to my knowledge, any other ways other than notifying them. What is often done, and you can check and see if Verizon does this, but apparently not, there's sort of the equivalent of a vacation message in which you can automatically have a message sent out to people who send you emails saying, oh, by the way, I'm on vacation. But in your case, it could say, oh, by the way, my email address has changed to such and such. But that may not be a feature that Verizon offers.
I've never heard of that with Verizon. So.
Yeah, I have not either, but then I...
All right, I'm just going to get depressed if we continue this conversation.
Okay,
like
get the Gmail address.
Yes, but anyway, with additional hard drive. Now, I have, as I said, an older computer, and the thing is that a technician installed an additional hard drive on my machine, which I completely cleared and put into a MyBook.
All right.
Now, can I install my printer and Kodak photo thing on that?
Some of it can be installed there. You're running an older version of Windows, I assume?
Yes. Windows XP.
Okay. Well, that's as long as you've kept it updated, that's okay. Basically, whenever you install various kinds of software, Windows will require that some of the software be actually installed on your main system drive, typically drive C.
I don't have any space left on that.
Well, what you may want to do, because some software simply requires that it be located in the same place as the main Windows directory, and you cannot completely install it on an external drive like a drive D or E. You may be able to install 90% of it on the external or extra drive. So what you might want to do if you've got that extra drive is look on your drive C and see if there are any things like photos themselves or other documents that you could indeed transfer over to the external drive to free up some space on your drive C. You really need to have some free space to do any more software installations on your main Windows drive. There's unfortunately no good way around that.
Well, the thing is, I don't know what I was told by a technician here in town, well, you're going to have to clear space off your C drive.
Right.
And I said, well, but how do I know how to do it? He said, well, you have to go through your system.
Well, and you may find, for example, if you've got photos and they're all in a photos folder, just one example, those can be stored any place. And so you could simply, using Windows Explorer, drag them from your C drive to whatever the other drive is.
Well, see, I did that originally when I got the new hard drive installed. I put all my photos on. The only thing is I have a lot of things in favorites in my folders.
Well, the favorites themselves oftentimes are just shortcuts pointing to the actual files. The technician was right. You'll have to go through it, and it can be difficult to pick out. You want to stay away from any of the folders inside the Windows or the system directories. But look for other folders, just looking right at the base root drive of drive C, and see what folder looks like. It sounds like it might be something that are your own files, and transfer those like you did with the photos. But it is a problem, especially with older machines, keeping enough space free on that C drive, and unfortunately there's no easy way around it.
Yeah, well, the thing is, as that other person was saying, that he might have ended up duplicating something. You know, that could have happened to me too, and I may, but I don't know how to get it out. That's the problem.
Well, yeah, it's my guess. My other suggestion then would be, if you've got a friend or neighbor, or a friend or neighbor's kid who's fairly computer literate, see if you could get them to come over for an hour or two and go through your C drive and pick out things that look like they may not be necessary. If they're copied over onto your external drive, and if it turns out that Windows doesn't like that, then you can always copy them back.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yes, good luck. It's quite
You're
a project.
Very welcome. Thanks for the call. And our news director, Peter, Tom Rogers, has emailed you a link to the Frontier Verizon issue. So if you want to check that, and I'll reintroduce us, and then we'll take another call.
All right.
This is Focus. My name is Celeste Quinn. And on the program this morning, we're talking about computers. It is a topic we take up here in the 11 o'clock hour of Focus. Once a month. Peter Kimball is our guest this month. He's with the FAST 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Listeners, you can join us this morning with a telephone call or by email. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. And the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Come up with anything there?
Well, I'm taking a look at the, bringing up the link, and here it is, the Verizon Frontier Frequently Asked Question file.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So we'll pop that up, and it'll tell us for anybody who wants to find this. Basically, the address is new.frontier.com/welcome.aspx. But I would suspect that just going to new.frontier.com by itself would probably do the job. Welcome to the new frontier, and someplace there should be frequently asked questions here.
And we can put a link to this on our website.
Yes, and you can choose your site, choose your state for Illinois, and it'll tell you about all of the things that you have to do and probably can't do.
Okay.
The only thing that's constant is change.
And let's take another call. This is a listener in Champaign on line 2. Hi.
Oh, hi. On a MacBook laptop, I'm trying to reduce power use and increase battery life. And one of the things that I notice takes a lot of power is Safari. So I'll have a bunch of windows open, apparently idle, and it will be taking, you know, a quarter of the CPU or something like that. So I tried installing a flash blocker, and that probably helps. But I think it's still, you know, trying to entertain me with animated images, and I'm not sure what all. And I'm wondering if there are other things that you know of that I can do that will just make it be still and wait for me to do something instead of trying to entertain me.
Other than just closing down Safari entirely.
Yeah, I could do that. But then, of course, I don't have the windows. I'd like to be able to see and read from the windows if I can. I mean, I guess I know that there's a history option so that if I close Safari, I can get the windows back,
yes,
at least so long as I'm still attached to the internet. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if there's something that I can do that would just, I don't know, suppress animated images or even suppress loading images altogether unless I click on them, or as some of the older browsers used to do, or maybe
well,
I
believe, although I haven't checked Safari lately, but I believe there may still be an option buried down there someplace in all the various tools to not download images. But that's not going to help a whole lot, because once the image is downloaded, there is no additional CPU time required. If it happens to be an animated GIF file, which are the, you know, kind of often annoying banner ads and such, those could be blocked, but they generally don't take much CPU power at all. It may be the thing to test and see if it cuts down on your Safari power usage would be to just have several Safari windows open to a completely static web page that doesn't do anything fancy. The most boring page you can imagine. Have two or three of them open so you know there are no flash, no animated files going on, and see if Safari is still sitting there, you know, doing its housekeeping in the background, and if that really is the problem with the power usage. It might be the Safari program itself.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh.
I'll try it.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call. Next we go to a listener in Urbana, line 3. Hi.
Yes, just a suggestion for anyone using a web-based mail. If you don't want to take a chance on losing your mail, the messages, you could use a program like Thunderbird and have it set up so that it downloads everything automatically. And then you've got it on your hard drive, and you can go back and get it whenever you want.
Which is a major advantage. In fact, Thunderbird, if somebody has Microsoft Office installed, Microsoft Outlook or even Outlook Express can do the same thing. You simply mm-hmm. specify that you want to copy it, and then you have a choice in many cases, either copy it and leave it on the server so you could still get to it from another machine, or copy it and delete it from the server. People with Gmail accounts generally don't bother doing that, because anytime you start getting any place close to your quota, Google increases it, and I don't know very many people who've gotten close to their quotas even.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, that's using what's called a desktop client. It also has the advantage that you can then compose email and get it ready to send without being connected to the internet, and only connect when you actually need to send it, and connect very briefly to download the email so you don't have to stay connected while you're reading the email. Which,
and you have your address book there.
You've got everything local, yes.
Mm-hmm. Just thought I'd make the suggestion.
I appreciate that very much.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks for that. This is Focus. We're talking about computers this morning with Peter Kimball of the Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We've got about 9 minutes left in the program, so if you'd like to join us, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. No one waiting at the moment. Well, we had that listener call in about Safari, and I haven't had time to think about this or look into it, but it seems that I updated Safari. There was an update, and
yes,
I went ahead and did that, and now the thing is running very slowly, or more slowly than ever before, and so I sort of just put Safari aside, and I'm using Firefox.
I have not heard of any specific problems with the most recent Safari, but it could well be. And again, my suggestion would be the same as for almost anyone. A Google search for Safari slows down, or slow Safari.
Mm-hmm.
It could be in part because the actual installation, it left bits and pieces of the old one there, so there may be some inefficiencies going on. The installation program should have taken care of that, but that's just one possibility. The other possibility is to completely remove Safari and then reinstall it. So it's essentially a brand new clean install of Safari, which doesn't take much more time than updating it.
Yeah.
And see if that takes care of it. If it is still slow, then there may be an update. They may have added some additional security features, which is good. But those could be slowing it down, and there'll be an update to address the speed issues.
Okay.
But a lot of people do the same sort of thing. They find that one update of a software package all of a sudden causes problems, and so they switch to one of the others. Firefox and Safari, fortunately, are two very viable options. On the Windows Machine Internet Explorer, Firefox, Opera, and a couple of others.
So that's what I did. I'll look into that and see what's up. But
kind of keep people posted next time and
see
if that fixed your problem.
See if I can figure that out. Do a little detective work over the next month. Next, we take a call from a listener in Aerosmith on line 4. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Yes. I live out on a farm, and we're trying to figure out how to get a wireless router for, like, Verizon. We're trying to get away from, DL. We don't have DSL out in the country. So I didn't know if there was a good way to get a wire, like Verizon Wireless, with a router to work our other computers on and a printer.
So you're thinking of using a wireless, a Verizon cellular connection for your...
Yes.
Okay.
I have a little netbook, and that works really well. And we have right now a Hughes, and it's not as good as the wireless.
And the Hughes is the satellite connection?
Yes.
Okay. So what you want to do is use your cellular connection, your cellular modem, to be able to connect multiple machines to the internet.
And a printer. Yes, and a printer.
Well, I'm not entirely positive what what kind of restrictions or limits Verizon puts on their cellular service, although we could look that up. Basically, you already have a home network environment.
Yes, we have a link system router.
And you've got the printer connected to it, so you can locally, at least without going out to the internet, you can print to your printer from any of the machines.
Right.
And the problem is that you only have access to the internet through the one machine that has the Verizon network card plugged into it.
Right. Well, what we have is the Hughes plugs into the back of the router, then we have our main computer plugs into the router, and then we have wireless signal that comes out so we can get another laptop and a netbook. We can all connect to that and plus print, and the printer is hooked into the router.
Okay.
But we want to do away with that and come up with we thought maybe if Verizon's wireless had that little, looks like a credit card, but that doesn't have a USB port.
That's correct, because that's just designed to plug into one of the PC card slots in the computer system.
Okay.
So there are and I'm just kind of winging this here at the moment, there are one option, because that Verizon card is intended for just a single machine. That's why it's not actually set up as a router. But you could certainly, if you've got a machine that you are going to leave connected full-time, onto your home network, you could plug the Verizon card into that, and then are you using a Windows environment, I take it?
Yes, we have Windows 7 on the main.
Okay. Then the machine into which you have your the little credit card kind of thing, the Verizon cellular network card plugged into one of your machines, mm-hmm. and then turn on internet connection sharing on that machine.
Oh, okay.
So that from the other machines you'll be able to get to it. Now the wrinkle, and I know that will work. The question is, will that also work if your connection from that machine that has the Verizon card in it, you have that connected? Presumably that, to keep things simple, would be wired directly into your router.
Okay.
And then you should be able to see that machine from any other machine connected to the router. And if you've turned on internet connection sharing, you should be able to get through there. Now, is this against Verizon's rules? Probably, but will they know? Well, I don't know.
Okay.
But that's what you need to do. You're looking at something called internet connection sharing, and that's a feature that you'll find in Windows, certainly.
Okay, great.
Good luck with it.
Good luck. Okay. This is Focus. Peter Kimball is our guest this morning. We're talking about computers. 333-945-5800, 222-9455. And the email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. And I think we might have a call coming in. So we'll wait and see.
Let me just say, for travelers, because we may not have enough time to do this.
Okay.
If you've got your own laptop and you're taking it, mm-hmm. some basic common sense things. First of all, if there's personal information on it, like you were using it to do your taxes, just take that off. You know, if the laptop gets out away from you, you don't want people to have all of that information. Make a backup of anything that's important to you. It probably won't be stolen. Update all your antivirus software. Make sure that you've done that, because if you haven't, it's difficult to do sometimes on the road. It's good, and again, we're looking at the possibility of the thing being stolen. It's good to set a power-on password. You can turn that off once you have returned home, but that way, even to boot up before it even gets to Windows, it says, what is your password? That can be done by normally when the computer first starts up and it says press F2 or F10 or something for setup, you can do that. But if you do that, do not forget that password. Write it down and leave it at home.
Okay.
Write it down, because if you forget that password, you're kind of up the proverbial creek.
Yeah, okay. Well, we've got a couple of callers waiting now, and what we're going to do is we'll see if we can get at least one, maybe two. So we're going to go to Charleston next. Line two, hi.
I just had a comment. They were talking about the Verizon card that's like a card wireless.
Yes.
I actually have one. And I don't know if that's what he was talking about, but I can run up to 5 different computers on it.
Okay, great. So that answers the question then as to whether Verizon allows that sort of connection. Good
deal.
They
just have to buy the special card, and it costs the same as buying the single card.
Great. So. Good to know. Thank you very much.
Bye.
And next we take a call from a listener in McLean County on line 3. Hello.
Hi. I'm going to make it very quick also.
Okay.
I don't know how to scan something and put it on a document, because I need to do it soon. So if you can give me a very quick lesson on it, I'd appreciate it.
You need to be able to scan it and then edit it.
Okay.
I'm asking, so you need to bring it into a document and then perhaps work with it. You don't need to just print it.
I need to scan it and then attach it to an email and send it. That's what I need to do.
Okay, that part is very simple. If you've got either a multifunction printer or a scanner, most people have a multifunction printer, you can simply, there's a setting on there, you can do it with software or with buttons actually on the panel.
Okay.
You scan it, it will save it as an image. It won't be editable, but it will be an image.
Okay.
And then that file, which could be stored as a JPEG or other file types, would simply be attached to your email just like any other kind of photograph would be, because that's what it is. It'll be a photograph, in essence, of your document.
Right. But how do I get it? See, I don't even do photographs. I don't even know how to download my picture. I don't know anything like that.
Well, what you'll need is you will need a printer or a scanner.
I have one.
Okay.
Okay.
And so you put the original, and what you want to do is scan it, and when you scan it, and if that printer is installed properly,
mm-hmm.
There will be a set of menu options on your computer
okay.
that will allow you to specify that you want to scan it, and it'll say, and where do you want to save it, what file will it be in. You don't have to plug in any other cables, assuming that the initial installation was done properly.
Okay.
The software will allow you to scan, and that's what you're looking to do, and it will simply say, where do you want to save it?
Mm-hmm.
You give it some name that hopefully you remember where you put it, probably be in My Documents on a Windows machine, and
okay.
then the scanner does its job, and from that point, all you do is go into your email program, say you want to do an attachment, and you specify that same file name.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
All right.
Okay, and there we've got to leave it. We are out of time. Also, someone called in this morning to say there is a free computer help desk at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, which is in downtown Urbana, and their email address is helpdesk@ucimc.org. Peter, thank you so much.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Okay, and next month we'll talk with the crew from the University of Illinois Sites.
And I'll see you in September.
Okay, see you in September.